What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast. My name is Jared, and today I'm joined here by the smallest crew we've ever had for a Show Me the Meaning episode, because today with me is only one member of the Show Me the Meaning team, and it is Lux. What's up, Lux?
Hey, dude. How's it going?
It's going good. This was strangely one of the hardest episodes to schedule. Originally, Ryan was supposed to be here, then he had to cancel, then we're going to do Bradless from our show Blackstage, and then he wasn't feeling well, so he had to cancel. The movie Midsommar is not out in Australia yet, so Austin couldn't do it, and then our producer Emily was going to join, and she got too nervous. So...
yeah, well, you know, it's not the easiest movie in the world to talk about.
Yeah.
I guess. For sure. I don't know. I mean, I say that, but I talk about this movie all the time, or I haven't since I saw it.
Yeah. Because it's fucking good. But we're going to talk about Midsommar today, the 2019 film written and directed by Ari Aster, starring Florence Pugh, is it? And Jack Rayner. What is it?
I think it's Pugh.
All right, cool. As always, we're going to go around and get first impressions. What was it like watching it the first time you saw it? What was it like revisiting it for this podcast? Or, since it's a relatively new movie, if you've only seen it once, tell me how you feel about it, Lux.
Well, I saw it twice, and I loved it both times.
Oh, cool.
The first time, I was really just, like, so fucked up by how good the cinematography and sound design was. Mm. Just, like, all the technical shit in the movie had me going nuts. So I had to see it again to, like, really appreciate a lot of the story and, like, theme stuff that was happening. Because the first time, I was just like, oh, goodness, this movie looks incredible.
It does look pretty awesome. Would you say better or worse than Hereditary?
I think I like this movie better than Hereditary, actually, for a couple of reasons.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah, I just thought it looked cooler. And then, like, yeah, I mean, we'll probably get into some of the other deeper reasons about things about this movie that are cool. But there was some stuff I liked better than Hereditary in here, for sure.
Yeah, I like this movie more than Hereditary. I love the shit out of this movie. I saw it about 3 weeks ago. I did not get to see it again, but I loved it. It was very haunting. It's a pretty long movie. What is it, like 2 hours and 40 minutes?
Yeah,
and
it's up there.
I was pretty glued to my seat the whole time. I thought Florence Pugh was amazing. I think Jack Rayner, or I mean, he looks to me like a young Star-Lord, but he's so hateable.
Yeah, to my whole thing, he had this real evil Seth Rogen vibe that I really liked.
I've seen people say that, but to me, he's so much more Chris Pratt.
Oh, I thought his profile, when he shot in profile, he looks so much like Seth Rogen.
Those performances, when it's just somebody who's so weaselly and hateable, I've recently grown like a real appreciation for being able to nail that tone of somebody that's so easy to hate. So I really actually appreciate his performance. But it's not one of those performances that he'll get a lot of love and respect for.
Well, no, especially because like to hit that kind of tone, you have to make them Weasley in a way that's like 50%+ relatable. Like you have to be shitty in a way where your audience can be like, oh, I could kind of imagine being shitty in that way.
It has to seem effortlessly shitty.
Yeah, and it's just to feel like, like a little bit like the movie's kind of making fun of you or people you know. Like it has to feel real and not just like I'm a shitty guy, but like I'm not trying to be shitty. I just suck.
Yeah.
And he does an incredible job. They all do. Like that's one of my favorite things about the movie is that everyone's trying not to suck. And they just suck because they're not great people.
They certainly aren't. All right. So we sound like we've got enthusiastic two of us for this movie. So let's go into a recap. So after losing her entire family in a horrific murder-suicide, grad student Danny joins her boyfriend Christian and his friends on a trip to rural Sweden where they will be joining exchange student Pella in studying and participating in the Midsommar Festival. Christian planned on breaking up with her before the tragedy and has been supporting her with the greatest reluctance. Upon arrival in Sweden, Danny and friends partake in psychedelics and are ushered into a series of bizarre ceremonies, the first of which ends with two elderly Swedes killing themselves in front of an audience. Deeply disturbed by this, some of Danny's friends decide to abruptly leave the festival, but Danny never sees them leave. They seemingly disappear without saying bye. After displays of bad behavior, like sneaking pictures of a forbidden text and peeing on an ancestral tree, more of Danny's friends are abruptly disappeared. Danny wins a maypole dancing competition and is dubbed the May Queen. Meanwhile, Christian is drugged and compelled to impregnate one of the Swedish girls in a very freaky ritual. Danny witnesses his infidelity and has a breakdown. Christian discovers that all of his disappeared friends have been murdered as part of a final act of sacrifice that closes out the festival. As the May Queen, Danny gets to decide who the final sacrifice will be, and she chooses Christian. As Christian and the other sacrifices burn, Danny smiles. End of movie. All right, guys, before we get into breaking down this freaky movie, want to give a shout out to our sponsors over at Manscaped. So, Manscaped is the number one in men's below-the-belt grooming. So, Lux, have you ever asked yourself, with what device do I shave my balls?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that's an obvious question that's going to come up eventually in your life for probably everyone with balls.
Especially if you're living on a budget and you can only get so many razors, do you reuse the one that you use on your face? I mean, you know, you can use soap and water on it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've asked these questions in my life. Well, you don't have to ask these questions anymore with Manscaped because they have this whole set that they sent us. They've even got, if you guys are watching the live stream, they've even got a nice little newspaper that says Balls to the Walls. It's a whole fake newspaper about manscaping. It's actually quite something. But it's all about not nicking yourself, making things safe, easy, and something that you do not have to do to both your face and your nether regions. So you can get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Wisecrack at manscaped.com. Again, that's 20% off plus free shipping at manscaped.com. They've got an electric razor I've got right here. They have another razor that they sent. They've got all sorts of lotions and stuff. Anyway, again, guys, that's manscaped.com, code Wisecrack. Do your balls a favor and get yourself some unique razors. All right, guys. So, Lux, I've got a hot take on this movie.
All right.
And considering some of the things that you and I have been talking about lately, I'm wondering if you have the same take. So should I just go for it?
Yeah, go for it. I want to hear it.
Okay. So specifically in the Tarantino video that you last wrote, you and I had been talking a lot about the value of ritual and kind of the lost value of ritual in the world.
Yeah.
And to me, this movie, and the key thing to remember here in this reading is that Danny smiles at the end. And I were meant to believe that I suppose she's staying with this new Swedish family and that she's going to continue to live. I mean, she doesn't have a family elsewhere. To me, this movie is about how the Western world has lost value in ritual and how we see it as some sort of spooky, irrational mysticism. So on the one hand, we have Danny, whose sister committed suicide. And although the details are unclear, I think we can assume she had a lack of support in dealing with her issues. Then, once the tragedy happens, Danny has the most unsympathetic, completely shitty support system in her boyfriend Christian, who does terrible things like guilting her into taking drugs that will give her panic attacks and forgetting her birthday, and being seemingly more interested in his thesis than, you know, taking care of his girlfriend who has undergone this horrible, horrible tragedy. She's completely on her own when she undergoes crying spells. He is a self-involved narcissist. On the other hand, we have the Midsummer Swedes that have a ritual form of dealing with pain as a community. And in two instances in the movie, we see when somebody is crying out in pain, the Mid-Sumerians or whatever you want to call them, they'll always mimic the crying. So the first time this happens is when the old man tries to throw himself off of the cliff and he hits the rock. He misses the rock and he's screaming in agony and everyone else in partaking in the ritual screams with him. And then this happens again when Danny witnesses Christian cheating on her and the other 10 girls are screaming in unison with her or they're mimicking her. They are, in a sense, sharing her pain. And this is why she smiles at the end, because in a perverse way, no matter how horrific the shit that we saw, Midsummer has given her a better alternative, a better support group, a kind of non-alienated existence that one would seek out, especially when you have no support group when dealing with the most horrific tragedy anybody can imagine. All right, that's my spiel. Am I right or wrong?
No, okay, so I buy this to a pretty large degree, right? Like, I think one thing this movie does that I really like that relates to sort of where you're getting at is, okay, actually, a good way to put this is, after the movie, I joked to my friends who I saw it with, that I was very into the idea of a cult that harmonizes with everything, that's, like, always doing a cappella harmonies of any noise that anyone does.
Oh, okay.
Because they're not just, it's not just those instances, right? Like, during the scene where Christian is, like, has sex with the girl, like, the people are harmonizing along with the girl. It happens, like, at weird parts during, like, when everyone's, like, eating or talking. Like, it happens in both, like, super sad or super happy contexts. Like, constantly throughout the movie, they're doing that kind of repeating thing. And I really like what that gets at and sort of how you put that, that it's, like, a communal dealing with, a communal sharing of feeling. And that's what I think the movie does that's so cool, is so many horror movies are, like, quote-unquote about trauma and quote-unquote about dealing with trauma. But in those movies, trauma is just, like, your parents got eaten by zombies, but now you've killed some zombies, and I bet you feel a lot better, huh?
Mm.
And that sucks and is dumb and doesn't really have a lot to do with how trauma actually works. Like, it's not something that you get over by, like, punching. And this movie does, like, really show a strong value in, like, the communal, like, the way that community functions to help people cope with trauma. I do think that it also does complicate that a little bit because, like, the cult's not 100% chill, you know?
Oh, of course not.
Like, that's, like, I think that's an important part of it, too, is that, like, I think you're right that it does show this, like, value of community as far as, like, a coping mechanism for trauma and a support system beyond, like, the traditional Western ones that we, like, have sort of isolated under, you know, modern, or within, like, the context of modern life. But then it also shows at the same time, like, how dangerous, like, choice and buy-in to these kind of rules can be, just in terms of, like, they murder all these people, which is pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And, like, the suicide thing is distressing, but actually, to me, kind of cool. But the murdering people thing is a bummer. And so it's... And that's part of why, like, it's better than Hereditary, right? Because Hereditary had this feeling of, like, if you zoom out on the world of Hereditary, this kind of sense of, like, metaphysical inevitability. Like, there are these demons that exist, and they're gonna get you. They're gonna get someone. They're getting these guys. But someone's gonna get got, that's for sure. And in this one, it's like, there was no metaphysical force that made anyone do this, right? Like, this was just some choices some people made.
Right.
And I think that's, like, that's much spookier, especially, like, in the world we live in now. Like... the, like, the way in which choice can become, like, all perverse in this weird, dramatic and dangerous way is, like, very interesting and very spooky in a way that, like, you know, congenital demon possession is, like, not as much.
So I guess I'm gonna go a little bit meta on the point that you just made. So, all right. Don't you think just in the very premise that we are creating this movie that shows this Swedish ritual that has all these horrific things happening. I mean, you could say that the kind of the self-imposed or the suicide thing is maybe less horrific, but of all the murdering and everything, and the fact that we're able to buy into this as sort of a, we as the audience are buying into how scary that is, isn't that kind of more to the point of how we see ritual as a kind of thing that does, like, as you said, I guess, so you're right, obviously, that the festival does horrific things and that we are seeing the cons of buying into a horrific system of values that is perpetuated for hundreds of thousands of years or whatever that has you ultimately kill people. But on another level, isn't it also that just the fact that we buy into the horror conceit of this shows how we as a Western society or as a Western audience are so skeptical of said rituals? Am I making sense?
No, that does make a lot of sense. And actually, that makes a ton of sense because especially if you think about how, like, yeah, they kill a bunch of people and that's a bummer and it's gross and weird and it's particularly visceral because, like, we're right there for it. And it's on a very small scale, but, like, a lot of big scale, rational thinking, calculated choices of, like, politics or, like, culture or whatever have, like, killed a lot of people. Like, many, many more people than Midsommar has killed.
Yeah.
And so to sort of be like, there is something to what you're saying, sort of like our rejection of ritual, it's, like, almost unthinking because, like, a lot of the same weird propositions of how society works that we live in, like, get people killed all the time. Just not, like, by having them, like, cut open and hung up in a chicken coop.
Yeah,
it's in different, more insidious ways. But I think you're right that it's like the knee jerk is like ritual. It's killing people. It's weird. It's creepy. But it's like, well, so does regular life if you like think about it.
Right. Now, I don't necessarily think that the movie is necessarily a cry for more rituals in our lives. But I do think that one of the reasons why it's so effective. And by the way, I think two really interesting choices that kind of add to this reading is one, this could have been just a movie where just some goofy kids, some goofy teens get caught up in this Midsommar ritual, but no, it's a woman who has gone through the worst tragedy someone can imagine. Your sister killing yourself and taking your mother and father with you. And I think that the fact that that is what she is dealing with and is able to find more comfort in these murderers, basically, than in her quote-unquote support group or her boyfriend, I think that it kind of begs us to ask those questions about whether or not these rituals have a real practical value to them.
Well, yeah, I think so. I think, I guess, I think we're agreeing on a lot of stuff. I think the big difference is I see this movie being more about trauma than ritual. Like, the degree to what's about ritual is the degree to which ritual plays a part in sort of this movie's understanding of, like, ways of coping with trauma,
mm-hmm.
rather than it being sort of the central theme of the deal. Because you're totally right. Like, there's a version of this movie that is totally fine. That is just like, we're all going to Sweden and, like, uh-oh, murders and whoa, spooky time. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the entire, like, 10-minute short film drama at the beginning that is so, so good. And super fucked up and sad that sets all this up and like positions them with this, like dealing with trauma and dealing with these like tense relationships. And that choice like makes her trauma and trauma in general sort of the forefront idea of the movie. And I think that definitely ritual plays a big part of that. But I think what the movie's most concerned about is like trauma, much in the same way, like is trauma and like experiencing it much in the same way Hereditary was like more concerned about like mental illness than it was like Lovecraftian like spooky guys.
Hmm. I'll only say one more point on this, and then I want to hear more about what you have to say about trauma, but I think it's relevant that the Americans are academics. It seems like kind of a strange choice, because essentially they're teenagers, or not teenagers, they're probably in their mid-20s or something like that, but usually when we think of these horror movies, it's like the clueless types who get sacrificed and killed, but I think that they have this perspective that they're studying this quote-unquote primitive ceremony, and it gives them this position of arrogance in a sense. I mean, we have the guy from Bandersnatch. What's that actor's name, the guy who pees on the tree?
Oh, God, I forget that guy's name. I know William Jackson Harper is Josh.
But yeah, he's but a
forget,
perfect example.
I forget the guy who plays Mark, but that guy, shouts out to that guy. That guy did a great job.
Yeah, that guy's an awesome actor. But yeah, even the fact that he pees on their ancestral tree, and even once he's reprimanded for it, he doesn't get it. He's like, what? I didn't know. It's just a tree. It'll dry. Whatever. I think, and the fact that he is such a jerk when it comes to supporting Dani and inviting her on the trip. She has gone through an utter catastrophe, and all he can think about is like, is this going to fuck up my game when I'm trying to bang all these Swedish girls or whatever? Is this going to mess up the bros trip? And so it's not that things happening in Midsommar aren't horrific. It's that Danny's sister, her sister's lack of community to help her through her pain and the ensuing fake performance of care towards Dani is equal. I don't want to say equally horrific, but also horrific. And the movie builds a really interesting discrepancy between the two of them.
No, that I think I totally agree with, especially like you said, in the context of them being like in their quote unquote intellectuals, because like they should sort of, they come from this like the sort of like privileged, knowledgeable position of like what's going on and thinking they know better, understand all this stuff. But it's sort of clear from the very beginning that they don't really understand anything meaningful, right? Because
they can't do the basic human thing of being sympathetic when your friend has this fucked up thing happen to them.
Right, exactly. So, like, the whole movie is about sort of how woefully unprepared these people who think they know everything is. And I think that does go to, like, A, how, like, our culture isn't great at dealing with trauma, even when we're trying to, and B, like you said, sort of how ritual or community play this bigger role that we sort of don't interact with directly in a lot of ways in our day-to-day life, which is, for this movie, if not a bummer, at least a thing to think about.
Did you feel any differently when it became clear that these kids were dying off? Because take a movie like Friday the 13th, when we have the teenagers being killed, and usually they do things like they're drinking or they're having unprotected sex, and so we're able to kind of look at them and saying, oh, well, they're morally transgressing, therefore they kind of deserve what's coming to them, or at least there's a sense of catharsis when we see them murdered because we feel the sense of moral elevation. Did you feel something similar here? Because obviously with Christian at the end, I was not at all upset that that guy was going to burn alive.
Yes and no. This gets one of my core things about horror movies is if you're making a horror movie, you got to make it so the people who are getting killed are people that I also like having on screen. Cause it's much more potent emotionally if you're like scared for characters and not like rooting for them to get murdered. It's also, I think, speaks to a weird part of our culture that we have a very popular subgenre of movies that is rooting for people to get murdered. But that's a bigger conversation, maybe. But
I wouldn't say I was rooting for these people to get murdered.
Right, well, that's what I was going to say. That's why I think this movie works, is that while you're right, like when Christian died, I was like, well, that seems to check out with everything else this movie has had to say about everything. I wasn't like hoping she would pick him, because I was also like, well, this guy's sort of trying his best. He's just a giant idiot. And I like that, that it had that balance. It had a sort of sense where, like, this speaks to the comedy of the movie, right? Like, the movie is funny as hell, is an important thing to note. Like, this movie is super funny. And it's funny without characters doing shtick. Like, it's not, like, references and, like, witticisms and snark. It's like how the character Mark, we were just talking about, Pete on the Tree, like, he's just vaping all the time. And it's, like, super out of place and weird. And, like, all the comedy comes from, like, bad timing or people not to suck, but instead sucking even more than you'd ever anticipated it being possible. Mm. And it's not shtick. It's, like, really natural character stuff. So I have, like, a greater degree of empathy for these characters, so I'm a little more worried for their safety, but at the same time, like, they do totally suck ass, and so I'm not furious when bad things happen to them, which is, like, a nice place to be as an audience member, because I neither feel, like, complicit in a weird murder ritual, nor do I feel, like, terrified for, like, my television friends.
Mm. Yeah. You reminded me of, in my theater, people were laughing a lot at the character's name is Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, when Mark is getting all, he's getting eyed from the girl, and he's like, was she looking at me? And then when he gets eventually lured to her, which ultimately ends up killing him, people were laughing a lot at just his weird, awkward attempt at game.
Yeah, no, he's so fun. Well, that's the thing, is like, so much of this movie is really funny, because it is just like, Mark thinks he's a lot cooler than he is. Like, Josh thinks he's a lot more impressively intelligent than he is. Christian thinks he's a lot more, like, leading man-y than he is. Pelle seems fine, but the other guys all, like, sort of think that they're more than they are, and they're constantly falling short of, like, the image they try to project is, like, an extremely real kind of comedy, because you see that in real life constantly all the time, and also just a really effective one. And it was one where, like, this is a testament to this movie, is that there was no point, there was only one part of this movie where I was, like, taken out of the movie by what was happening, and that's when Christian drinks the menstrual blood potion at the dinner, and his drink is just, like, a radically different color than everyone else's drink. Mm. And I was just like, you gotta notice that your drink is just totally different.
I know, but he's such a wiener. He's right. Like, oh, I don't want to have a bad trip, and then 5 seconds later, he just downs it because he's a little bitch.
I know, but you can't be sitting at a table and everyone's drink is yellow and yours is bright-ass red. And you're just like, yeah, this seems normal. This seems fine.
But he wanted to be manipulated.
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm saying that's like the one, well, what I was trying to say is that that's like the one thing in the movie that like took me out where I was like, this seems silly. But the rest of the time, even when they were doing all these jokes and things that I was laughing at or reacting to, I was still like fully in the movie because none of it came from like referencey bullshit or like shticky stuff or like tone changes or music cues. Like it was all just built out of the characters and the story in a way that felt really organic and good and made it easy to get to have a good time while also be like kind of terrified by the circumstances.
Okay, I want to talk about your ideas of trauma. You said you mostly read this film through the lens of trauma. I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, we can definitely, yeah. So the thing with this movie, right, is that it's what I like to call, or what I've been calling a big time dread movie. Like, it's not a movie where Toni Collette crawls in the ceilings or thing just bursts into flames or like there's like big screamy jump scares really at all. It's a movie where you get the feeling that something bad is going to happen or that bad things are happening. And that feeling just keeps mounting and mounting and mounting and mounting and mounting and mounting and mounting throughout. And I really like this as sort of a way of thinking about trauma because the movie starts off, like we've talked about a bunch of times, like with Danny learning about her sister killing herself and her parents. And then becoming very depressed about that for like obvious reasons. And the whole movie following it, because we're mostly in Danny's perspective, is about her going on this trip and stuff and still dealing with and processing all those emotions. And at the end, like Jared points out, like you said, Jared, she smiles when she like sets Christian and all of her friends' corpses on fire. And I also read that much like you did as like, that's like, she's bought into this thing, this like curative thing. And I think the sort of key to that is like Pele gives her this speech, right? Where he's like, my parents died when I was a kid. I know what it's like, but I had this whole family, this whole support system. So I never felt, like, trapped or smothered by, like, the grief or pain or trauma of all of it. Whereas you have, like, Christian, and he sucks. and so that's pretty bad, right? And so it really presents these alternative ways of dealing with trauma, like, this very, like, atomized capitalism version of, like, you depend on this small support system, and you don't really talk about it, and it's, like, trauma's a thing that you have for yourself, and you reconcile with it. Versus this communal, like, we all sharing it together. Like, you know, I make the joke about this being the cult that harmonizes with everything, but, like, that's them sharing experience together. And, like, modern Western, like, liberal democracy capitalism is very much about your experience is your own.
Mm.
Which is, you know, that has its own pluses and minuses or whatever, but one of the minuses is that we don't have the sort of, like, attempt to share pain or share feelings in the same kind of way. And because of that, big, hard-to-explain feelings are really tough to, like, share and deal with. This movie sort of shows that there's, like, an alternative way of doing that. And that trauma is something that can be processed communally, not individually, and that in doing that, like, maybe that's healthier or better. Which I kind of do agree with. I don't, again, condone the methods 100%, but, like, the thesis seems, like, relatively strong to me.
Did you feel like there was a bit of fantasy that comes with this, in that men who are watching the movie are attracted to the idea of being surrounded by a bunch of hot Swedish women who are all horned up and ready to mate? And I don't know, I'm wondering if, and we don't have any women on this podcast, but I wonder if women would similarly see a fantasy in the character of Pelle, who, to your point, is endlessly nurturing and always speaking very romantically.
Well, I can definitely speak to some women I know who I saw the movie with and I've talked to on internet. Have all agreed that Pelle is like supremely hot and seems like he'd be a great boyfriend.
Dreamboat.
Yeah, absolutely dreamboat. So, I mean, I think you're not, there's not nothing there. And I also think that, like, this movie plays to a sort of, like, it's hard to say, like, gendered fantasy, because I don't want to, like, paint pictures of specific gender perspectives, but, like, there's obviously, in the way that, like, America presents culture, like, individual coping is a very masculinized thing, and, like, communal sitting around talking about our feelings is a very feminized thing. And this is a movie that really, like, show, like, goes in on that second option in a real way, as, like, that can actually be the foundational model for a community, not the other one. Which is very interesting and very cool, and I think is a reason why, I mean, I don't know, you know, I can't speak to this universally, but at least within, like, my internet sphere, most of the people I've seen complain about this movie are mostly men, and most of the women I know have seen this movie think it's fantastic. And I think that there's something to that, that this movie challenges some normative, like, you know, like Andrea Dworkin levels of, like, ingrained, you know, ingrained, like, masculine culture stuff, and, like, tweaks those things in a way that maybe isn't obvious if you're not really thinking about it. But yeah, I think it really does in a cool way because of this shit that I just said, basically.
Yeah, to your point, when Pelle first gets there, he immediately meets someone. I don't know if it's his dad or his uncle or something like that, but the way that they embrace each other, like, they just are grabbing each other by the napes of their neck and just looking directly into each other's eyes. In a way, that's a kind of intimacy, whether between men or between women, either way, that you just don't see these days. And it's probably the kind of intimacy that Danny needed, but wasn't getting from Christian the shitbag.
Right, totally. I mean, I want to say it's Adorno, but I could be wrong. But there's a number of Frankfurt School theorists and other people like that who talk about one of the big things that capitalism does is it atomizes the society, right? It makes us all individuals operating rather than, like, conceiving of ourselves as a group. And for various reasons, that's beneficial for the system, like no revolutions or, like, makes unionizing or whatever. But this idea of atomization is, like, a big part of what modern, like, liberal democracy capitalism looks like. And I really like that this movie critiques that in a way that isn't just like, oh, capitalism, it's gonna get you. Like, rich people, they're gonna eat your bones or whatever. But it's actually, like, this has a real emotional cost.
No, I really like the complexity of it because, once again, as we've said, it's not the Western system that's killing people. Or, well, I mean, it's still a Western country, but it's not it's the rural communitarian image that is doing the murdering, that is the source of all the horror. Well, maybe not all of the horror. But anyway, before we go on, guys, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors over at the University of Texas, El Paso. So this one's personal to me because I was a student of the UT system. I went to UT Austin, and University of Texas of El Paso, their goal is to make getting a degree reachable. So getting a degree can seem like an unreachable goal, especially if you have a job, kids, or other family obligations. Maybe you don't have time, maybe you don't have the money to go back to school, but University of Texas El Paso is part of the country's largest university system, and they have a suite of fully online degree programs known as UTEP Connect. That's University of Texas El Paso Connect, that is made to make it so that you can remove as many barriers as possible when you get a degree. They're flexible and convenient, accessible from anywhere, affordable with one of the lowest tuition rates within the UT system. which is saying something because I went through the UT system and didn't pay much. It's the same that you would get on campus with the same great content and professors. So go to utepconnect.utep.edu or call UTEP Connect at 1-800-684-UTEP today for more information. Again, that's utepconnect.utep.edu or 1-800-684-UTEP today. And now back to the show. All right, Lux, I wanted to go into a little bit of just minor details about the actual Midsummer Festival. I'm sure that most people know that it's not actually like this. Do you know much about the real Midsummer Festival?
No, I'm shamefully minimal about this. I should look that up. It didn't even occur to me to be like, oh, this is probably a real thing.
Well, it is a real thing, but it was initially a pagan festival ushering in summer as the longest day of the year. I mean, it is very old. But then after Catholicism became the dominant religion, it became a celebration of the birth of John the Baptist. Today, it's mostly about nature and light, and it really is just seemingly a excuse for people in Sweden to get together, run around outside, play some silly games, like they have one game. Well, first of all, the Maypole dance is real. They don't take psychedelics, as far as I was able to tell, but they'll play games like putting a stick putting a stick against your head and then like running around in circles until you get too dizzy and then fall down. So the maypole thing is real. Flowers are also similarly a key aesthetic. Women wear flowers, even put flowers under their pillows so that they'll dream of their future husband. So Ari Aster kind of played with that and made it, what is it, like some sort of wooden icon that she puts under Christian's bed?
She carves like a rune on a stick and puts it under his bed.
Yeah, so he played around with that a little bit. But yeah, Midsummer's a real thing. You know, in the movie, they said that it was every 90 years they do some sort of legit Midsummer Festival, and I wasn't able to find anything about that. But if anyone is Swedish and is listening, please send us an email, movies@wisecrack.co, for any other things that Aster might have adapted from the actual festival.
Yeah, I also did like with that, I mean, I don't know if this is adapted from real life or not, but it's one thing I liked is that there were like little drops of festival backstory that like hinted at like a spooky like world before the world of men kind of thing.
Yeah, but I love the production design, all those painted backgrounds of, you know, the women like shaving their pubes.
Yeah, or like them with the bear. Or with the
I'm now thinking I should have used that to transition into the Manscaped ad, but totally lost me on that. But yeah, the bear thing for sure.
I really liked before the Maypole dance. They talked about how like it's a celebration of like this battle against like the dark old ones, but they fought till they all fell down, and now they all fell down because from dancing and not from dying. Mm. And it's like a fuck you to the great old ones or whatever. Like, I love that shit. And I liked, like, this is part of my problem with Hereditary, right? Was that, and I might have talked to you about this, I don't think on the podcast, but something in regular life, that like, it was so cool when I didn't really know what the cult was about in Hereditary. Mm, and then at the end, They're like, here's our deal. We're naked and we're weird and we got a demon. And it's like, what? Okay. Like,
hail Paimon.
Yeah. But that's like, that's not, you know, that doesn't feel, it like loses so much of its impact, or lost much of its impact for me at the end. It just felt like a million other things I'd seen. And I think this movie did a really good job of cultivating a sense of mystery that even by the end of the movie, like a lot of the questions aren't really answered. But the story is tied up in a satisfying way, despite the fact there's still like questions left.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. Can we talk about the technical shit in this movie for a second?
Yeah, please.
Because it's crazy. There's a shot in a lot of horror movies that I think is a pretty classic one where there's the car driving down the street and the camera rotates over the top of it so it flips upside down.
Don't they even have that in Hereditary?
I think they use that in Hereditary. There's a lot of things. It's sort of always like that we're passing from like one zone to the next zone kind of imagery. Mm-hmm. What I loved in this movie is that then they cut to the same perspective but reversed, or like to the reverse angle, but kept it upside down and then wheeled the thing back over the car again. Like you did like a full 360 using these like blend cuts. And like that was fucking gorgeous. And it set this like tone of all of these times where the movie uses like it pans to the left and then blends into a movement that goes back to the right and time has passed or we're somewhere else. And it used that in a really cool way, especially when contrasted with how it showed gore, which was like almost always just like a hard cut to something super gross, which I fucking loved. Like There were times Ari Aster has a real gift for getting you into a sense of security and then just fucking you up tremendously. One example in this movie being like after the old people jump off the cliff and die, everyone's talking about it and, you know, dealing with it. And then the next cut is like a hard cut to their dead bodies all gored up being cremated. And it's like cut from all these sad people being like, this is crazy, to like, oh, corpses. And you've no reason to expect corpses in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just such a good job of like freaking you out, not with threats of a spooky thing around the corner, but just like reminding you of like what's happening right now.
To your first point about the camera doing interesting upside down inverted things, one of my favorites is when before they go on the trip, we see Danny, she's about to have a panic attack. This is when Pele first tries to console her and say, hey, I've been there. I'm really sorry about what you've been through. And then she starts to have this panic attack and she runs to the bathroom and it's an overhead shot. And as she nears the bathroom in the overhead shot, she closes the door and then we're in the plane and they're already on their way to Sweden. And not only is it super disorienting and kind of giving us that subjectivity of somebody who's dealing with something as fucked up as she is, but also I just love how it communicates the passage of time and specifically that she hasn't gotten any better. Things have not gotten better. She's still going on this trip in a very, very deranged mental state and that Christian has not helped her.
Right, the time has passed, but she's in the same place.
Yeah.
And that rules. The movie's just so fucking good at all these little visual tricks.
Yeah.
That I just like, it's constantly doing these things where like it's tricking you with location. And the other thing that was always so impressive about this movie is it's like the only drugs movie that like feels like the people who made it have done drugs. Because like usually in movies, it'll be like someone takes some kind of weird drug and then it's like everything's neon colors and it's swirly. And now the animals are talking and what's going on?
A little bit of swirly stuff here.
A little bit, yeah. But it was all sort of subtle. Like it was just like flowers like breathing or like opening and closing in a way that didn't make sense. Or like body parts blending into the ground or like the ground blending into the sky. Or all these like weird perceptual things, but it felt like much less. It worked to do this thing where like it wasn't that the tripping out was like these crazy visuals. It was like everything seems weird, and the weird behavior started to feel more normal, which is much more like, you know, in line with drug things as they exist in real life. Like it's not that everything seems crazy; it's that things are weird, but that seems normal. And the movie achieves that in a much realer way than like I don't know, altered states. Or something like that.
I fucking love that movie.
I mean, Altered States is good, but it's definitely like a goofy drugs movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You mentioned earlier, you were talking about Hereditary, and you were talking about the end cult scene, and how the end of the movie is Hail Paimon, Hail Paimon, which is definitely reminiscent of the end of Rosemary's Baby, spoiler alert, where it's Hail Satan, Hail Satan. But have you ever seen The Wicker Man?
Oh, yeah, both versions.
Okay, so I have only seen the Nicolas Cage one, and I admit that I only saw it because I wanted to see him scream, ah, the bees, the bees. So somebody told me that this movie, not only visually, but also in terms of plot, reminded them of Wicker Man a lot. Did that happen for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely, it follows a similar structure of, like, the cult movie, right? Like, the cult horror exists. I think it's something that that you and I were both kind of talking around earlier in the show. Like, cult horror exists because it's like, what if all the rules that we have that make life make sense didn't exist and there were different rules, and wouldn't that be scary and weird? Especially if all these people accept these like other rules as just being natural and normal. Isn't that fucking wild? And that's like what The Wicker Man is too. I don't think it, maybe I'm misremembering it, but I think The Wicker Man has a much less like, maybe this is okay vibe at the end. I think the end of The Wicker Man is pretty like, these people just burned that guy. Spoilers. And so, but it is very similar in the sense that like, it's a lot of like stuff that seems okay, but you feel weird about it because it's a little bit off. And then it's like increasingly off. And then it's like, oh, murders are happening. And it does have that in common, but I think cult horror in general kind of has that. I think that's part of why it's sort of like, or folk horror, I guess a better way to put it. Like, folk horror has that kind of energy to it, and I think that's really good and compelling, this idea of, like, what's scary about it isn't like a group of old Swedish people. It's that a group of old Swedish people have all decided that this is how society works, and they've all agreed, and everyone's okay with it. And, like, that's spooky to think about, because, like, you know.
Yeah, but so during that one part in the movie where they describe, I don't remember exactly what the line is, but it's something like 7 years of learning, then you work from age blank to blank, and then you only, and then you study from ages blank to blank, and then you die. Did that not speak to you at all? Were you just kind of like, damn, I could get down with that?
No, I liked that. I liked that whole thing of like you're like a kid until you're like seven, and then from 7 to 18 you work. Then 18 to 36, you go out in the world, and 36 and to 54, you come back and you're part of everything and you help raise the next generation. And then from 54 to 72, you're old and then you die. And like, yeah, there's an appeal to that. Not even for like Malthusian reasons, because Malthus is wrong and for overpopulation is not, whatever, we can get into that later. But what's interesting about it is that like it does sort of, another thing of like just the world, like the post-Enlightenment world we live in, is like this idea that being alive is inherently good, which is a thing that I controversially don't agree with. I think that being alive is a neutral, is a value neutral proposition.
Well, then I guess the cultists weren't doing anything terribly wrong when they killed all those people.
Yeah, at least not all the people. You know, it varies. It's a case by, like I said, it's a value neutral proposition. It's a case by case kind of thing. But I think that they're making that assertion, right? That, like, being alive doesn't really have value in and of itself. It's what you do at those times where you are alive that, like, ascribe value to the act of life.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, so you get your 72 years, and it's broken up into these sections, and you do your thing. And that's how, like, your life provides value. But being alive in and of itself, like, being 80 and decrepit in Sweden in a place that has no, like, electricity, and, like, yeah, I mean, maybe it's dead, you should be dead. You know, Schopenhauer agrees. That's just sort of the... I think there's value to that perspective. Again, you know, there's also, it's a bummer, but it does, I think it did resonate with me in that way. It's like, yeah, the value of being alive past 72 is like a real mutable question.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention that is interesting about how in Hereditary, there was much more of a distinct source in this devil figure. So apparently, and I read this on the internet, so the town or the commune is called Harga, and it was chosen because it has an association with a real Swedish legend known as, and I'm going to butcher this, the Harglaten. Basically, the devil arrives in Harga, disguises a fiddler, and tricks the young locals into dancing themselves to death. And I found it interesting that he chose to place it in within a community that has this folk devil figure, but not really bind any of the horror in any kind of supernatural devil-like elements.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this goes to the same thing that I've been harping on, like, people being weird is way spookier than magic being weird, because magic's weird.
Yeah,
that's what the whole fucking point of magic is, that it's weird. And you know, like, obviously there's ten, but like, okay, like a good example is like that movie Crawl with the alligators. I just saw that
Crawl. How was it?
It was, I loved it.
Okay.
It was dumb as shit, but I had a great time. It had, did you see Gerald's Game?
I have not.
Okay. Gerald's Game is a very gross scene, and Crawl has like a ton of versions of that exact same sequence. It's weird, but very good. But the point is that like, that wasn't scary, right? It's like tense because you're like, these are alligators, but it's not scary because like alligators eat shit. Like, it's not abnormal or weird. It's just intense and you know, it's just tense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is much scarier to me because this feels like a possible thing of just people being crazy, as opposed to like, you know, so like Hereditary, it's like, you know, demons are going to try and possess people. It's what they do.
Yeah.
It's normal. And it's like the spook, the less I know about those demons, the more effective it is for me, because at least then I'm like scared by the unknown. But Hereditary botches that job too, because it tells you the whole fucking thing at the end. And so I think that this movie does a great job. I'm also, to be fair, much more partial to these dread movies than like a jump scare movie. And I think that this kind of idea of like the setting itself, the possibility of the movie itself is scary, is more appealing to me than like the specific situation. But this movie, like, yeah, I just love that this movie really achieved that in a really good way. And like you said, like, it's, I don't need it. Yeah. I just, people are scarier than basically everything. mm-hmm. Except for clowns. And most clowns are people. And so this movie does, like, for me, it was really effective in that particular way. Like, in that way of just like, I'm very uncomfortable right now and I'm a little afraid.
Yeah, it was a solid 2.5 hours of being uncomfortable. That was very enjoyable for me. Do you have anything else that you want to add?
What else is in this movie that was very, very cool? Yeah, the one thing I really enjoyed about this movie also was this idea, like, I just loved, I mean, everyone's been talking about this shit, but I fucking love that it was just, like, the brightest, most colorful fucking thing.
Oh, yeah. The sunniest horror movie ever didn't have to rely on darkness.
Yeah, because it was, again, like, it wasn't relying on, like, things hiding the shadows. It was just relying on you, like, making a scary situation in your own head. If you want in on that, like, you can just do it. Like, yeah. That's just going to happen no matter the setting. And so, yeah, I mean, that's basically my main thing. I just thought it was so fucking impressive. Like, it's an ambitious fucking movie to make. To make, like, a cult horror, folk horror movie that's also a breakup movie that's, like, also stylistically distinct from, like, every other horror movie I've ever seen.
And it all took place, or most of it took place in a field. I imagine it was also very cheap to make, which is amazing. I mean, that's the only way that movies like this continue to get made. So, hats off to Ari Aster. I was not entirely sold on you being an amazing auteur after Hereditary, but now I'm sold.
Yeah, totally. Also, do you know the origin story of this movie getting made?
He said something that he had it was a breakup that caused this, right?
Well, it was that he got an offer to write just like the Swedish horror movie. And he was like, this sucks and is boring. But I was just going through this terrible breakup and I want to write about that. So I'm going to write about both these movies at the same time together. And then this movie happened.
Is there one side of the breakup that he more identified with? Did he break up with somebody who underwent something tragic? Did he go through something tragic? Or is that all just created?
My understanding is that he was sort of the Danny of the story. I don't think he went through anything nearly as bad as that. Mm-hmm. But that, like, he was in a bad place and that he was sort of the one who was sort of suffered for the whole dynamic. As I understand it. Which, like, you can tell in the movie because it all feels very real. And it's just like, that's such a crazy way to make a movie. But then they just did it. Also, it's crazy that movie's all shot in Hungary. I did not know until recently.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet you his ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend, whatever, is probably not happy to see him or herself embodied in Christian, the biggest cheese dick character of the year.
Yeah. But the only thing that Christian and his friends is like, it was a little bit, that was a real, I feel personally targeted by this relatable content moments with that. And just in the sense of like, the Wisecrack staff is like all like grad students or post-grad people for the most part are like intellectuals of some type. And there is definitely like, none of us are nearly so shitty, but there was a shared type of shitty DNA across that movie that like I found both, which made it much funnier to me in a lot of ways, but also made me be like, oh, I gotta be a better guy, baby.
I hear that. All right, guys, one more shout out I want to give out to another podcast, This Week in Movies. So if you guys listen to this podcast, you'll notice that one thing we don't do is we don't do up-to-date movie news, but you can get that at This Week at Movies. If you enjoy discussion of themes, wonder which movies you want to see and which you should skip, what's coming out this weekend, you can stay in the loop with This Week in Movies podcast, or TWIM for short. Fresh reviews, analysis, insights from the latest movies. They won't spoil any of these movies without first giving you a warning, unlike us, because you know that we'll spoil stuff if you're clicking on it. So it's a weekly podcast. You can subscribe now on your podcast platform of choice. And without further ado, we're going to go into the mailbag. So you guys can send us an email at movies@wisecrack.co. But first, we're going to go into our voicemails at 213-534-8807 or 21ELFGUT07. We actually got a voicemail from Dave about Midsommar. So let's hear what Dave has to say.
Hey, this is Barry from Maryland. I'm just calling about the ending of Midsommar. I just wanted to talk about how Danny's aspect was completely destroyed with that sacrificial fire. Like how Christian represents Danny's aloofness and lack of initiative with herself, Danny, which is why Christian doesn't have that initiative either. And Josh represents like Danny's possible obsession that she could have to the point where she ignores boundary lines and stuff, which would get somebody, you know, in trouble. And Mark represents Danny's naivety, or one could view it as foolishness, hence why he was a pool head. And the two pair, and the two sets of couples, I think the younger couple represents Danny's current relationship with Christian, so that's why that has to be destroyed as well. And the older couple represents their possible future relationship that they can have, because you see that they're not really happy throughout the entire movie, the older couple. So this could be a possible future for Danny to have, that she's not going to be happy with Christian if she continues this. So I feel like when the fire finally burns these bodies, she's finally destroying the negative aspects of herself in order to better herself. Because this is the first time, I believe, you ever actually see Danny truly smiling and happy, and is finally getting rid of this negative weight that she has upon her. Let me know what you guys think. All right, thanks. Bye.
All right, Dave. So I really like what he said about it being a indication of Danny going from inactive to active, because I do like the idea that she should have dropped Christian in her life before she should have seen the signs of him not being supportive enough, of him being a shitty boyfriend, and dropped him. And it's perhaps poetic that ultimately she does it by burning him alive. But I don't know if I agree. So Lux, the older couple that he's talking about, is he talking about the couple that jumps off the cliff?
I mean, I think so, right? I think it's the only older couple, right? Because yeah. The other couple is like Simon and what's her name? But they're the same age and they're just British, is their thing.
Well, I think that for the most part, one of the reasons why I kind of stick by my initial hot take reading is because none of the people that are part of the Midsummer community show any kind of angst or despair or anything. They all seem actually quite happy. I'm curious as to why he thinks that they were unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, that I don't get, because I think the movie makes a big point of the fact that they're fine with it.
Mm.
Like, the movie makes a big point of the fact that, like, there's the whole thing, right, where the guys are freaking out after they jump off the cliff, and that lady's like, you have to understand, like, we all think this is good and cool.
Right.
And so that part I do kind of disagree with. I do like his take that, like, it's like, it ties into the trauma thing, right? It's that, like, sure, Danny probably should have broken up with Christian at some point, but you can't really blame her when her life gets, like, thrown into utter chaos. And he's like the one thing that has, like, she has an anchor to.
Sure.
But then, like, the moment she can sort of get past that is the moment that she's, like, coped with her trauma. Right? Mm. Like, that allows her to, like, take back her agency or whatever. And I do like that element of his question. And I like the idea that these characters she's with kind of represent sort of problems that she has with herself that she needs to grow through. I don't think it's, like, necessarily one-to-one, but I do think there's some juice to this, just the idea that, like, this process allows her to become a more fully actualized person, and that's part of the arc of the movie. I think that's, like, a pretty reasonable claim.
Absolutely. Lux, have you seen Spider-Man Far From Home?
Oh, yeah.
All right, cool. We got a call from Anonymous about Spider-Man. Go, Anonymous.
Hello. Wisecrack, Anime Avenger here, and I was calling in response to your Spider-Man Homecoming podcast. Now, I was very interested when I saw it as the illusions that Mysterio uses, almost as if it's a meta-commentary on the illusions of movies and how we put our trust in them, and that we believe the illusions. So I was just wondering what you guys thought about that, with how we put our trust in movies and everything in the illusions of the entertainment industry. Thank you.
I don't know what he means by that. I mean, we obviously know that these special effects are fake. I don't think the movie is making the point that if you find comfort or any kind of existential reassurance in superhero movies, you ought not to. I don't think the movie's making that claim at all. What do you think, Lux?
No, I kind of agree. I think that this take is strong. This take, like many, is stronger if you push it further. I think that it's less about, like, this is an indictment of the movie industry, but it's an indictment of, like, the sort of self-narrativization and narrativization of the world, right? Like, it's all Spider-Man fighting illusions and, like, mysteries, whatever. Because, like, you know, the world, like, we tell ourselves a story about how the world works and how things go, and they're never true or right. And, like the whole movie is Spider-Man telling himself the story that he can just be a normal high school kid, that, like, his superhero-ness doesn't matter, doesn't, like, make him part of this bigger thing.
He's
trying to trick himself in that way. And so, of course, like, Mysterio is using tricks and illusions, because, like, it's all about Spider-Man's perception and, like, inability to see, like, the truth of the world.
Oh, I really like that. I like how saying that the fact that he thinks he can have great power without great responsibility is an illusion that Mysterio puts on him. I like that a lot.
Yeah, well, I think that is, and it's an experience, one that he signs up for. And then, like, that's... And so I think it's making, like, a bigger claim than just, like, movies are trying to trick you. Because, like, yeah, we're all getting signed up to be tricked by movies. It's that we trick ourselves and the world tricks us. And then a big part of, like, growing into, like, the fully formed version of yourself is trying to learn the difference. And that's why I like that movie a lot. Not as much as the first one, but I still liked it a lot.
Yeah. All right, we're going to move on to the emails. Once again, guys, if you want to give us a call, 213-534-8807 or 21ElfGut07. I imagine, Lux, you've seen Blade Runner, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So we got a... Oh, so yeah, if you want to send us an email, it's movies@wisecrack.co, not.com. So we got this email from Radic. He said, I was very excited to hear your podcast about Blade Runner recently, especially with such a strong roster of cinema buffs. I agree with what you said about having to ask the human replicant question is the whole point and not being able to answer it. All the more disappointed I was to hear that most of you thought that the above question was answered in 2049. I feel, and I hope a lot of people agree, that the whole reason why the sequel works so great is that it doesn't answer the question if Deckard is a replicant or a human. I understand that some part of the audience will be hung on the argument that Deckard lived long, so he was definitely a human. The age limit on replicants was stated to be artificial, and there wasn't much stopping from designing replicants without this limitation. Also, Wallace was suggesting in his conversation with Deckard that he was designed to fall in love with Rachel and that he might be a replicant. We don't know if it was to mess with Deckard's head or actually true. It doesn't matter. The strong points of the movie were that it expanded on the questions of humanity by introducing a third category, human AI, represented by Joy, and showing off Kay, or Joe, as the most hopeful and human character we meet. So, thank you for writing in. I need to see Blade Runner 2049 again. I've only seen it once in theaters. I don't remember a lot of it. Do you remember 2049 well, Lux?
Yeah, and there's one detail in particular that makes me think that this take doesn't make sense, because isn't a big part of the movie, like a big part of the sort of central issue of the movie, that there are people who can exist whose parents are both a human and a replicant, right?
Isn't that a central contention? I remember Ryan Gosling. I remember the girlfriend, digital girlfriend. I remember there being a lot of baptismal water and Jared Leto being creepy.
Jared Leto in that movie is a fucking crime. I hated that performance. But yeah, I think that if I remember correctly, I believe that part of it is that like the magical MacGuffin girl is Harrison Ford's daughter, right?
I believe that's the case.
She's like. And that a big thing is that, like, it's Harrison Ford and Rachel, the replicant's daughter. And if the thing is that two replicants can make another replicant, that's feels much less pressing to me. So I'm pretty sure. But yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that movie. I mostly remember how good that movie is at tilting the camera up the sides of very pointy buildings. But if I remember correctly, that doesn't quite hold up. And it also doesn't, like, the message's point to me seemed to be about how, like, caring about this distinction takes some of the interest away from like this third category. But I think the whole point is not that we should care about the third category so much as we should care about how the existence of the third category complicates the other two.
Well, all I can say, Radic, is that I don't want to say anything if I haven't recently watched the movie with it fresh in my mind. So I will watch it at some point, and we will definitely do 2049. And hopefully I will be able to better answer your question. We got a really interesting reading from Paulo. He said, I'm writing regarding the unicorn sequence and why it matters on the case that Deckard is a replicant debate, although in the end it doesn't really matter to the enjoyment of the movie. On the film, every replicant is paired with an animal. Zora, snake, Roy, dove, Rachel, owl, Leo, lion, Pris, raccoon, because of her crazy makeup at the end, and Deckard is paired with a unicorn, which is not a real animal, but a fantasy one. In my interpretation, this is done to show not only that Deckard is a replicant, but also a special one that may have a longer expiration time, which would explain him being on the sequel. There are also other suggestions to this point, like his abnormal strength, like hanging on a ledge with broken fingers, that's a good point, and stamina, and the scene where he is shown with big bright eyes, from Paulo. I had never heard this thing about the animals, but Zora, snake, obviously. Roy has the dove at the end. Rachel, there's an owl in Tyrell's office. Leo, lion. Leon. Wait, why Leon and the lion?
I mean, if nothing else, the etymology the name is right there.
Okay. Pris the raccoon, absolutely. The makeup in the eyes definitely makes her look like a raccoon. I like this reading. What do you think, Lux?
Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, part of it is, maybe this is just part of how I spent the last year on the Game of Thrones grind for us. But man, these like hyper-specific text reading conspiracy things drive me fucking insane at this point. I think this is a good one. This is one of the more interesting ones I've heard about anything in a very long time.
Game of Thrones is over, man. It doesn't even matter, man. Clear your head of that shit.
Yeah, but it's just that, I think this one's very good. I think that, again, it's more important that this conversation exists, right? And things like this are good for that. Because again, like the movie and the book, and I'm always going to sort of harken back to Philip K. Dick, because Philip K. Dick's very important to me, always seem to sort of be like mostly interested in like complicating the things that we assume about identity categories rather than like inventing new ones or like teasing out what it means to be a robot. It's like more about like what's the line of where human starts and ends, right? And stuff like this, I think, is these debates all really strengthen that discussion. I think that's like the most interesting thing about the movie.
Sure. All right, Lux, I'll leave it to you. You want more Spider-Man or more Blade Runner?
Let's do Spider-Man, because I watched that movie much more recently than I've seen the Blade Runner movie.
Sure. Hey, Wisecrack, my name is Tamiya, and I've been listening to the podcast for a while now, and I really appreciate your takes on all these films. I recently saw Far From Home, and I want to address this scene that really was obvious to me, but everyone else seemed to ignore. Remember in the bar when Peter gave Quentin Edith? He did so by speaking into the pair of glasses, giving Mysterio access. However, at the end of the film, Peter manages to take Edith from Mysterio, tells Edith to destroy the drones, without Quentin giving access back to him. Can you explain this? How did Peter use Edith without gaining back access? You know what, Tamiya? I thought the same thing, but then I said to myself, oh, you know what? Probably doesn't matter. But I did think about this, but I guess we just have to conclude that when you grant access to someone else, it doesn't preclude you from maintaining access.
Yeah, I mean, I think here's my in-fiction comic book explanation for this. So the glasses had to recognize Peter in order to start working in the first place. They had some kind of like biometric connection. So Peter can provide other people access, but the factory standard on the Edith is that it like clicks into Peter's genes or whatever, or some biometric. So like, even if he gives permission over to Quentin, once he gets it back and has it in his hands, the thing will respond to him because it's programmed to respond to his biometrics always. I don't know if that's true. That's my comic book explanation.
I dig that. All right, this one's from Zane. I think you're going to like this one, Lux. This is from Zane. Zane says, watching Far From Home made me overthink details that might seem subliminal. For example, Spider-Man's iconic blue and red suit is swapped out for a new black and red suit. The original reason for the blue and red was for patriotic reasons that Peter took from his idolization of Captain America, which was later retconned to Peter taking the colors from the radioactive spider. The switch from blue to black may have similar political / nationalistic motivations that given the highly politicized climate of Europe at the moment and their distaste for Americanization in this sense. Am I going crazy? What do you think? I would say, I mean, yeah, probably going crazy, simply because I don't think Marvel's not in the business of casting shade on any countries, especially America, where the movies are made.
Yeah,
what do you think, Lux?
Especially where American movies are made, and America, which low-key pays for some of their movies.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't fully understand, what's the color change thing he's talking about with regards to Europe?
He says the switch from blue to black may have similar political nationalistic motivations given the highly politicized climate of Europe at the moment. I think he's just saying that basically Spider-Man doesn't look like a America fuck yeah symbol at the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I think that would be cool, right? Because black and red coding is all anarchist leftist stuff, which I'm very into.
I doubt it. That would be like saying that Darth Maul is into that shit, which I highly doubt. Yeah. Zane, good thinking, but I'm going to say probably impossible. All right, let's do this last one. This is from Josh. Josh says, hey, crackheads, have you ever been called that? We have. My name is Josh. I'm from Australia and love the podcast. In regards to Far From Home and the Blip, I'm surprised none of you mentioned Martin Starr's character's wife, who pretended to be blipped so she could run away with another man. I wouldn't be surprised if more people did things like this. The ultimate time to escape your debts, too. Also, is Tony Stark the ultimate Marvel villain? He basically created all the villains in his films, Spider-Man films, Ultron, and it's said that him coming out as a superhero inspired the desire to challenge, making Earth a magnet for conflict. Just some thought. I think that one of the things that's great about Far From Home is that it definitely introduced or reintroduced some nuance to the consequences of Tony's actions. And that was really welcomed, and that was really refreshing, and that was really interesting. I don't know if I would go as far as to say that he's the ultimate Marvel villain. He's still in terms of the IP sense, he's still a hero. But I like the idea of painting us heroes and then encouraging the audience to analyze their legacies critically.
Yeah, Marvel plays a cool trick that I gotta say I'm a fan of in a way, and also frustrated by another, which is it constantly makes movies that complicate the value of superheroes as an idea, and then spends a lot of time being like, but actually they're good for sure, don't worry. Mm-hmm. I think that's just what this question is getting at. Like, yeah, like, Tony Stark accidentally made Ultron. Tony Stark does the fucking Iron Man 3 fucking whatever it's called superpower juice plot, like, ends up triggering a bunch of bad shit in the Infinity Stone movies. But like, all in all, like, Thanos was going to be Thanosing around in space regardless, right? The Kree are going to be Kreeing it up no matter what. Like, all this shit is happening, and whether or not Iron Man exists or not, like, that shit still matters. And so without Iron Man, everyone dies, right? At the end of the day, if you zoom out far enough, the thing what he's getting at that is true is that, like, this great man theory that Marvel likes to have, they're implicating themselves in the sense of, like, yeah, Tony Stark does all these things to help people, but because of that, and because he's so driven to be the one who does the thing, he has unexpected outcomes that are also bad. So we got to think about it, which is fair, but they ultimately clearly come down the side of, like, but it's overall good.
Of course it's good. They got to make more movies, man.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to go and wrap it up. Thank you guys for writing in. Thank you guys for listening. Want to remind everybody that we've got a new podcast out called Culture Binge. That's where me, Alec, who's been on the podcast a couple times, and a newcomer named Serby are going to be breaking down random shit that happens in the zeitgeist every week, trying to subject it to analysis like we often do. I want to thank my single guest, Lux, for joining me today. Thanks for joining, Lux.
Hey, no problem. Glad to do it.
Yep, so check out Culture Binge on RSS. And until next time, next week we're definitely doing the new Tarantino movie. We're going to be doing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood next week. Can't wait to see it. Really stoked. But until then, see you guys next time. Peace.
Later.